It's been a minute since I've recorded an intro, but I am back. I hope everyone had a lovely and restful holiday with your family, your friends, any of your loved ones. I went back to the East Coast and ate probably 100 cookies, barely exercised, and just took time and hung out on the couch while watching holiday movies. So it was definitely the break that I needed. I feel like there was a lot of burnout in the air the last few months of the year for myself and the people around me. So just a reminder to anyone who's listening to take the time for yourself and prioritize self-care before you actually really, really need it. Take breaks, go for walks, do what you think is best. I really needed my brain to just stop for a week in order for me to reset and get back into my usual routine with a fresh perspective, which the new year kind of always brings. But I'm trying to find my love for cooking and exercising and writing again. So with that being said, I owe you a little extra content. I will be dropping 3 new episodes throughout the next few weeks, including a rerun episode that garnered the highest listens in 2024. Okay, so now on to the incredible guest I have for you. Hethel Vasabada is a cookbook author, content creator, among many other titles, and recently launched her newest cookbook named Desi Bakes. We dug very deep into her journey on MasterChef. Doing this podcast and just through my work, I've heard a lot of experiences on food television shows, good and bad. And when I was editing this back, the stories Hethel tells were reigniting the frustration I felt when I first heard them from her. So in a time of a lot of uncertainty, I just wanted to say to follow your passion, whether that's cooking or anything else, and don't let these, and I'm using a tame word here, but manipulative outside forces try to tear you down. Hethel is a great example of how you can learn and teach and impact communities in a positive way. So I hope you enjoy listening to this episode as much as I enjoyed experiencing it. I also wanted to note that Hethel mentioned a partnership that was in conjunction with the holiday season, so that is over now. But I do want you guys to take note of the organization she was partnering with named Cookies for Kids Cancer. I'll actually link it in the description of the episode so you can check it out. So with all that being said, please join me in welcoming the lovely Hethel Vasabada. 1, 2, 3, 4. There's one thing I want to say. I love the color of your headphones.
Thanks. Nice and bright.
I know. I have these gray ones I've been using, but recently my podcast mic just decided not to work on me. So That's why I'm without the headphones today. It is so, so good to meet you. I appreciate you taking the time out on this busy Monday, I'm sure. Mondays are always my craziest day, so I understand. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I saw you were a former East Coaster now living in the West Coast.
Yeah. Wait, where are you from?
I'm from Connecticut.
Okay. Jersey. Same, Okay. Whatever, tri-state.
Same difference. I would always go through there. We would drive to Florida every year, so I would always be going through New Jersey and everything. But I would go there, too, just to, like, go to bars and go out and stuff.
Yeah.
When did you move to the Bay Area?
Now it's been almost 12 years.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah, so you love it.
I'm a Cali girl. I'm too soft. I can't go back.
Yeah, no, same. Do you go back for holidays?
Yeah, I was just home for Thanksgiving. And then I'll go back a couple of times just because, like, I grew up like 10 miles outside of New York City. And I end up doing a lot of work in New York. So I'll just go home and see my parents and, like, head to the city for work and come back. Yeah, I go back as often as I can, mostly because I miss the pizza and bagels.
No, same.
I'm like, it's not the same here, guys. It's not that great.
It's not. I will say I did have I think it was a good bagel. I'm going to classify it as a good bagel. The other day that my friend brought to her birthday brunch, and I was thoroughly impressed because I haven't had any bagels I've liked here, and I've had zero pizza that I've liked here. I think it was called Hank's. I think it was from there, but I have to
You're in LA, right?
Yeah, yeah. I'm in West Hollywood.
Yeah. Yeah. There's only one bagel I've enjoyed in LA. And it was so long ago. And I remember being really excited because it was like a proper size. The thing with bagels out here in California is they're always like so small. And like, you know, in New York, the bagel, you can eat half for breakfast, half for lunch. Like they're big. Yeah.
They're watching them. See, I'm just inhaling bread. So.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yep. I understand. Well, if you find a good pizza place, let me know because I'm still on the hunt. I mean, but you're farther up than me for sure.
Yeah. There's some, I haven't had one good one in LA. They're always too fancy. They're always like the, you yeah. know, fire, brick fire oven, all that stuff. And I'm like,
they have their artisan and they have, which yeah. I love a good artisan pizza. Like I'm never against it, but sometimes you just want a cheese, you know?
Yeah. Sometimes you just need a $2 yeah. slice from the corner pizza shop.
Yeah. I went to, are you familiar with Connecticut?
Yeah.
Okay, so do you know like the whole pizza street and stuff? Like,
yeah.
And all that? Okay.
Yep, yep, near New Haven.
The Colony Grill. Okay. I had that when I was home and I was like, you just can't beat it. No. I'm sorry.
No, you can't. You can't.
Are you thin crust or thick crust or either?
Either. It depends on my mood. But if I'm going to get a thin crust, it can't be floppy. Like it has to be like a proper New York style. Like in Philly, there's a spot called Lorenzo's. That does a thin okay. crust pizza and like it's got like if you fold it in half the tip is not just like you know drooping to the floor, like you need it to have structure.
Oh, I agree. Yeah,
yeah.
I watched the Barstool videos too. It's all about the one bite. So I kind of like to get into the background of my guests first. You're a Jersey native, we chatted about, but where do your Indian roots come from? I read that your mom influenced your cooking greatly. Did she grow up here? What's the reason?
So both my parents immigrated from India. Both my parents immigrated from India in the late 80s. And they're both from Gujarat, which is like the little peninsula that hangs off the west coast of India. I grew up vegetarian. I grew up eating Gujarati food every single day. I lived an hour outside of Edison and an hour away from Jackson Heights. So we grew all our produce for the most part.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And I grew up in Bloomfield, which is a very Italian place. Like all my neighbors were Italian. They filmed The Sopranos in my town. The finale was filmed like in my town. Like it's all.
Whoa.
Very like Jersey Boys has a shout out to Bloomfield. Like it's a very Italian town.
Okay. As an Italian, maybe I should have known that. But I did not.
It is like. Everyone I knew was Italian for the most part. So I grew up in a very like Italian bubble and all the Indian food we had, either we grew or we would have to do like an hour long trip to Jackson Heights or to Edison to go get groceries. So New Jersey does have a very large population of Indians. I think it's like the highest population of Indians outside of India.
Oh, wow. I had no idea.
Yeah. We're there.
We love Jersey.
but they're mostly like, there's like pockets of it. So like in Parsippany and Edison and that whole area and then in Princeton. So there's pockets of it. And I did not grow in one of the Indian pockets. I grew up in an Italian pocket. But yeah.
Okay. I'm biased. So. Well, I love that for you. So if you were... around food production, like when you were young, I mean, if you were producing your own food, are you doing that today? How has that influenced you now? Yeah.
So I grow in the summers, I will grow a lot of my own produce. I grow my own edible flowers. I grow all my herbs. I did like corn and potatoes this year.
No way. Wait, I want to do that.
I was like, I just want to know, like, I just want to know if I can do it. And it worked.
Corn, though, has to have so much space, no?
No, you could put 6 stalks in a 20-gallon bag. And then I just watered it often because it does require a lot of water. And then I ended up growing, like, a bean plant, like black-eyed peas. I just took some dried black-eyed peas and tried to see if it would sprout, and they did.
Oh, my gosh. Yeah.
So I grew those with it. And then I grow, like, I have a lettuce grow, like, it's a hydroponic growing system. So I'll grow a lot of produce in that as well.
Oh, just casual.
Yeah.
You're like, just the whole system.
Yeah. Fine. It's not like my parents had, like, a full, we had an in-ground pool that they filled with dirt. And then they had rows, wow. They still do. They had rows and rows of produce. Now it's, that's like half our backyard, but it used to be our entire backyard and front yard when I was younger.
Whoa. But didn't you want to swim in the pool?
The food was more important. I was like 3 when they did this, and I remember being very upset. But
I would feel like, you finally got me a pool, and now it's full of dirt.
Yep. And we grew everything, like all the Indian produce that you don't easily find at the stores. So like green bottle gourd, okra, eggplants, all the different chilies, all the different herbs and tomatoes and whatnot. So it was very like, you know, chores were go home, water the plants, do your homework, water the plants, prep the food, water the plants. There was no,
you had one goal and you knew what to do.
Yeah, there's no irrigation system. I was the irrigation system.
Yeah. Farmers could use you today. That's so funny. Well, that's incredible. Wow. To like learn that so young. Mm-hmm. So your parents then were very involved in cooking. So did you watch them as a kid?
I mean, I had to be a part of it because I grew up in a joint family. So my dad has 6 brothers and 2 sisters, and my mom's got 6 sisters and a brother. And so like once my parents came to America, they sponsored a good amount of all of my mom's sisters got sponsored by my family. And then most of my dad's family, that like 4 or 5 of their brothers. So we all lived together at one point. So like any given point of my life, it's a lot of people. We had anywhere between 10 to 15 people living in our house. And it's like a small Cape Cod house. Like it's not like we're living in a McMansion. We're living in a tiny Cape Cod house. So it was like, you know, dinner was a production. You had to make a lot of food for a lot of people. And not just like dinner, but also everyone's lunch for the next day. And we ate traditional Gujarati food. So you know how like the typical American plate is like meat, veg, starch?
Yes.
So for us, our traditional meals for Gujarati meal is dal bhat shak rotli. So dal is dal, like lentil soup. Bhat is rice. And then you have shak, which is usually any like vegetable-based curry. Or it could be meat-based too, but since we're vegetarian, it was just vegetable-based for us. And then rotli is our flatbread. So a very, very – it's like a super thin, like a chapati or a paratha, but much thinner. So that makes the basis of our plate. And then you have accompaniments like chutneys and yogurt or pickles, things like that. Every day we had
that. Those can all be made in bulk.
Yeah,
right?
So we'd have to make dal in bulk, but it was fresh every day. So we made the rotli fresh every day. We made the shak fresh every day. So like my job when I was little was to prep the veg. So, you know, cut off the ends and chop it up, whatever it may be. And then as you move up, right? Oh yeah. Like my daughter was like 3 years old at my mom's house. And my mom sent me a video of her like prepping some beans. And like cutting the ends off the green beans. And I'm like,
gotta work from young.
Right. And I'm like, oh my God. But yeah, she started now and I started very young too. And then over time, I had to then make the dough for the rotli. Then it was, okay, you're going to make the dal. Then, like as I got older, what I was allowed to do became like, I got more responsibilities. So I was able to learn the entire process of making that meal. And like now as, you know, living by myself out here in California, I realized like being able to make that type of meal every day requires a lot of people.
I'm sure. I don't doubt. Even like taking soup or something requires. I mean, I can do it myself, but I would love another pair of hands.
Yeah. And even though we're having rice every day, we weren't making in bulk. Same with dal. We weren't making in bulk. It was fresh every day. There was no leftovers. It was.
And they were working simultaneously?
Yep.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's crazy.
They put in a lot of effort. They definitely instilled the idea of having a hot, fresh meal and like the care that you put into that. in me. And I feel like, you know, I try to cook every meal. But I think one thing that separates, I think, my immigrant parents from the first generation of Indian Americans is that we are willing to take shortcuts.
You don't have to tell me twice. I'll take a shortcut.
Yeah, I'm like, I'm not going to make fresh roti. I think I'll just buy it from the store.
Is your mom cringing? Like,
ah. And I was like, why would you do that? I'm like, because it's easier. You know, I'm not going to make homemade pickles. So Indian pickles are different from what you would consider a traditional pickle, which is usually brined in like vinegar or, right? Ours are different. Ours are usually done in oil and then a bunch of spices are added to it. So it's a different style and it's really, it's not hard, but it does take time. Cause you have to like dry out, you dry out the carrots and you know, a lot of it's done in the sun.
Is that like a different flavoring probably more than we do here?
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So it's more like a preservation versus a pickle, to be honest. It's preserved in the oil and spices, but we have some that are like a quick pickle. Like we have carrots that you will pickle in lime juice and crushed mustard seeds.
Oh
yeah. So like our mango pickles are usually done in oil. So it's easier to just buy it from the store than to make it at home. My mom and my aunt make it fresh. Like anytime I go home to Jersey, I'm bringing home jars of pickle.
Well, that's good for you. I mean, I bring home jars of sauce. Mm. So, I mean, it's the same wavelength.
Yeah.
Are you a home baker or did you have classical training as you grew up?
I had no training whatsoever. I started baking in college and then... Okay. I'm self-taught all the way. I did try to go to pastry school after I got off MasterChef. I got in. I had like the wildest. This is like a low-key brag. Gordon Ramsay and Christina Tosi wrote my recommendations to get into pastry school.
No way. Really? Yeah. I love Christina too. That's a crazy brag, actually. That's a crazy brag.
And I was just like,
how'd you say that? Did they just offer?
So they had told me when I was on MasterChef, like, you should consider going to pastry school.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, I thought maybe that's the next step. But I had a 2-month-old at the time. And the pastry school that I applied to was SF Cooking School, which had a part-time pastry program, which I could do. But then they shut down their part-time program that year, and it was only full-time. And they didn't have a payment plan. So I would have to not only just, you know, pull out 30 plus grand, I'd also have to figure out childcare for my like 2-month-old, which is going to be insane. So I was like, I can't afford this. Like, this is not something I can do right now and put our family through. So instead, I staged and I did recipe development for various brands. And eventually, okay, SF Cooking reached out because their marketing director ended up going on maternity leave. And they're like, hey, do you want to take over? And they're like, you could, you know, sit in on any class that you want. I sat in on like a couple classes here and there. And it was fun for the most part. I'm self-taught.
Wow. Okay, that's incredible. I want to reel back a little bit. Because that was in, what, 2016?
Yeah, 2017, 2016, yeah.
Okay. So... before that, I saw you majored in biochemistry. Then you had business and administrative type of work and roles. But were you simultaneously blogging and creating content at that time?
I was. I was blogging since college. Okay. I started with a Tumblr called Philly.
Oh, wow. Throwback. Yeah.
I was a Philly food girl on Tumblr. And my photos are like horrendous. Like, they're just so bad.
I had this show, I understand.
I had my little digital camera, my Olympus digital camera that I used to take photos.
Those are in,
right?
Those are
I know. In. I'm like seeing like all my little cousins with it, and I'm like, oh, I had one of those.
If they bring flip phones back, though, I'm kind of over it.
No, I'm good. No, thank you. I don't want to be texting on T9. I'm good.
Yeah, I'm good.
So we ended up working in business, applying for MasterChef, and then blogging throughout the whole thing. I knew that if I wanted to take like my 15 seconds of fame from MasterChef, I needed to use social media to my like best abilities. Mm-hmm. And then I blogged during that time too. So I've been blogging since forever. I didn't really put myself into like full time until like 2016, 2017.
Okay. So your brand name, Milk and Cardamom, I found it to be pretty unique. What's the inspiration behind that?
A friend of mine had found a lovely poem a couple of years ago, actually right after MasterChef. It was someone I met during MasterChef who sent me this poem about this woman. It's about a grandmother and her kids moving to America and how she's from the land of milk and cardamom and like just talking about the immigrant experience. And it reminded me a lot of my grandmother because my grandmother would make me warm milk with cardamom in it at night to help us sleep. Like me and my sister.
That sounds so comforting.
Very cozy. And she would wear a silk chiffon sari every day. And the thing with chiffon is it'll take on the aromas of whatever's around it.
Okay.
So her saris would smell like cardamom because she'd make chai and she'd make my cardamom milk for me. And she'd make sweets for me and my sister. And all those scents that she'd be working with, typically cardamom, would like almost like saturate her sari. And like I have memories of like being a little kid and like hugging her and my face is like, you know, full in her sari and just like it just smelled like cardamom all the time. So it was just like an ode to her.
I like the change, but Philly food girl's gotta be iconic.
Yeah. And then I was like, wait, I don't live in Philly no more. I'm in New York. Yeah. Then I was in Cali and I was like, I gotta change it. I gotta give myself a new name.
Rebrand.
Yeah, exactly.
That's very sweet. So your grandma certainly probably influenced you as well. But I am interested, how old is your daughter?
She's 8 now.
Oh, she's 8 years old. Okay. I want to hear about your MasterChef experience because you said you applied. Was there anyone behind you, maybe your mom or grandma at the time or whoever it was that pushed you to apply? Was this something you did on your own?
My husband pushed me to apply. He could see I was like literally dying at my corporate job. I was working in consulting and I hated it like with a deep, deep passion. It's just the corporate world is not for me. I am not a corporate bad, you know, like girly bot. That's not me. I'm not.
You'll never see me in an office. I won't do it.
Yeah. No, thank you. I really didn't like it. And my husband saw like the only solace I had every day was like coming home and making dinner or baking something. Any excuse to bake. I'd be like, oh, I'll bake a fail cake since we like didn't meet our goals, or I'll bake a cake because we did meet our goals. Any excuse, I'll take it. Like they had me catering their client meetings at one point. Like, oh, can you make some breakfast pastries for our corporate client meetings and stuff? So I was like, yeah, if you're going to pay me, sure, I'm out. So I very much did not like it. So he was like, why don't you try for MasterChef? Because like one of the things, and this is, I think, something that's no longer, a taboo. But back then, to call yourself a chef and not go to culinary school was like a no-no, right?
Yeah, culinary school is a very big deal.
Yeah, I've had restaurant experience. I worked as like a line cook and waitress and cake decorator and all sorts of, like, I worked in the food industry pretty much all of college and grad, but it was just like a job to help pay for school. It wasn't like, I'm going to make this my life.
Yeah, you weren't like actively trying to learn anything.
Yeah. So I had one reservations of like, how can I ask people to pay me for food when I'm not a chef and didn't go to culinary school? And I definitely didn't have the confidence to tell people to pay me for my food. I also wasn't sure, like, am I really good? Are my friends and family, friends and family always are going to say everything I make is good. You know what I mean? Like they're obligated.
My mom. They'll tell me when I suck.
But like, I need some validation. He's like, why don't you go on MasterChef? It's other home cooks. Like, you know, Gordon Ramsay's not going to tell you who likes your food if he hates it. Like, let's be real.
And
tried out and I just kept making it past every round. And I'm just like, I don't know what's happening, guys. Like, what was going on? But I made it very far. I made it And spoiler alert, top six, which is like two episodes from the finale. Once I got off, I was able to start working with a lot of, because that's when meal kit companies became big, like the Blue Apron and Plate Joy and Sunbasket and all those guys started coming out.
Uh-huh.
So I started doing recipe development for a lot of them and working with like appliance companies and new startups to create like the recipe books that go with their appliances and just a lot of recipe development. And then over time that grew into writing a cookbook and then doing food writing for magazines.
Okay. Yeah, I was looking at some, I write for Food and Wine. Mm-hmm. So I was looking at some of your articles on there. I want to hear about what your experience was like on the show though, because I've heard different narratives from several different people. So I'm curious what you personally thought about your experience since you almost made it to the end.
Traumatizing. I would say,
you mean Gordon Ramsay yelling at you isn't fun?
I think they know, they have an idea of what type of person they want to win, because I think they have a plan on what's next. Because one thing that they don't let you know is that they, in the contract, they put in that they have the option to take up to 15% of your income for the next 3 years.
Whoa.
With the option to extend that into perpetuity.
What? I've never heard that. That's insane.
They also have to yay or nay anything that you do in the food industry. You want to do a pop-up, you have to ask permission. You want to do a YouTube channel, you got to ask permission. You want to write a cookbook, you have to ask permission and be prepared to give up to 15% of whatever money that you're making off of it.
As if they needed more money.
Yeah. You're also not allowed to reach out to press or do any PR.
So, wait, what?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's crazy, because I've interviewed, oh, you know what though? I've interviewed the judges more, mm-hmm. but I'm pretty sure the winners, unless MasterChef is doing it on their end and they're like,
if press reaches out to you, that's one thing. Then you have to loop in the MasterChef team and then they will coordinate it. But you yourself cannot reach out to any writers or get any press unless MasterChef approves it.
Wow. So that's if you're the winner.
No. That's if you're just on the show.
Wow. Okay. So did you sign that?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. I understand. I understand signing it.
Yeah.
As well.
So I used a loophole. I had my sister reach out to people on my behalf. Was not allowed to do YouTube channels or anything like that, unfortunately, because they considered it a business conflict. But instead, I started writing my cookbook. I know that they own the copyright to any recipe you make on the show. So after you film the episode, you have to sit down and write the whole recipe out, and they have ownership of that recipe. And I knew that a recipe can't be copywritten.
Mm-hmm.
So I would like share a version of that recipe where maybe there's an extra quarter teaspoon of cardamom or an extra tablespoon of milk, you know?
Okay.
So
kind of get around.
Exactly. I'm like, they can't do anything about it. So
yeah.
I kind of like, I knew what I signed, but because I knew what I signed, I knew where I could push it and where I couldn't push it. Right.
Right.
And then I had a lot of startups that I worked with where like they paid me in equity.
Okay.
Rather than cash. So that wasn't something that I could give up to MasterChef.
Okay, smart.
Yeah. So I went about it the best way I could. And I basically, if you're going to go on one of these shows, one, know that you are just cattle. You're there for the entertainment. And once it's over, it's over. They literally don't care about you after it's done. And just, you are a means to an end. They have my face on pots and pans at TJ Maxx. I don't get a dime of it. Yeah, because they have a MasterChef brand, pots and pans that they sell. And I had a couple people send me pictures of it. It's like all of us lined up. And I'm like, are you kidding? But yeah, you're not going to make any money off of MasterChef. The second thing is use social media to the max.
Yeah, now you can. I mean, was Instagram?
Yeah.
I mean, back then Instagram was a thing, because I remember I was using it.
It was a thing, but it wasn't like you would go and follow a reality star. You know what I mean? You would only follow your friends and maybe a couple big name bloggers, but it wasn't huge. Like, I only got maybe like 5,000 followers off of being on MasterChef at the time. A majority of my followers came during the pandemic. So don't have any deep expectations on that side. Really start using social media to hook and keep the followers with you long term. So like engage them and keep them long term. The other thing is MasterChef does not, unlike a lot of other reality shows, they do not, I'm like trying to think of, so they don't care what people say on their Facebook page or anything. So people will make racist comments. They'll make sexist comments. They'll make just the most horrible comments. They don't manage the comments. They don't tell people that we don't bully. We don't do this. This is not appropriate. We're going to kick you out. None of that. They do not care. So you will see some of the most heinous things being said about folks in the Facebook and Reddit. You just kind of have to let it go.
Were you facing that?
Yeah, I had a lot of, so like they make me repeat that I'm vegetarian. I do not care if people eat meat. They can eat meat in front of me. I truly don't care. Because
they made you constantly repeat it on the show?
Yeah, they made me constantly say, I'm a vegetarian. And I'm like, I literally don't make it that big of a deal. But they made me say it so that I sound like a grating, like vegan or something. You know what I mean? That stereotypical vegan vegetarian. They made it look like I was crying over cooking meat and I wasn't. Like there's one episode where we had animal heads. And those animals' heads had been under those boxes for God knows how long at room temperature. So when I lifted my box, I had a goat head, which wasn't too bad. But the person behind me, I think, had a pig or a cow head. And it stank to high heaven.
Oh, gosh.
It was the nastiest. It actually made me gag. Cool. And then my eyes started watering because of how bad it smelled. And they made it look like I was crying over the fact that it was an animal head. When in reality, it just smelled so bad that I was getting nauseous and gagging.
Oh, it's all for ratings.
Yeah, it's all for ratings. It's all for ratings. There's like times where they're like, they gave us a recipe. So one thing that you like they do, you film every day of the week. And then one day of the week, well, not every day, 6 days a week. And then one day you get to have like test kitchen time. And they would kind of teach us certain recipes. You know how people like, how'd you know how to make this, that, the other, you know? It's because they kind of hint to you like what the next challenge is going to be. And they did like a ravioli. They taught us how to make ravioli, egg yolk ravioli. And in the dough, the recipe they gave us, you're supposed to use a whole egg, not just the yolks.
Okay.
To make the pasta dough itself. And then once we had the egg yolk, the pasta challenge, and one of the contestants got screamed at for using a whole egg in their pasta dough.
Isn't the point that you guys are doing it on your own?
Because apparently you're not supposed to use a whole egg. It's supposed to be only the egg yolks. And then I'm like, I'm pretty sure the recipe that you guys gave us uses the whole egg. And I went back and looked. And I remember like the Chris who they were yelling at looks up at me because I was the recipe, like I memorized everything.
Okay.
So I was typically the person most people went to when they were like, I don't know how to do this.
That's impressive because I have short-term memory.
So lost. I was like locked and loaded. And he looks up at me, but they make it look like he rolled his eyes at the judge, but he didn't. He was looking at me for like reassurance.
Okay, so it was filmed that I was trying to I was trying to watch it, but I couldn't find your season online at all. So I couldn't find found like certain clips.
Yeah.
But it's on television.
It's on Hulu. Yeah, yeah. So a lot of it's produced, you know. We were told that we weren't being dramatic enough, so that we need to create more drama. We're too nice to each other. If you don't give the producers what they want, you know, your veal may be dry.
All right.
Yeah.
I have a few. You got to
play the game. You got to play the game. That's all it is.
I understand in a rating sense that they want the drama, but I've, you know, Americans love drama. That's never going to change in any reality show. Even this is not a food comparison, but reality TV comparison. Love is Blind, if you've ever seen.
Oh, yeah.
The US version versus the UK version is night and day.
Mm-hmm. It's like Great British Bake Off, right? Like, I wish every food show was like Great British Bake Off or even MasterChef Australia versus our MasterChef.
Yeah, Curtis Stone. Yeah.
I hate that it's all about the drama. I want it to be about the food. I like the cozy camaraderie. I don't want to watch people fighting. Like, I'm already anxious enough. We already see people fight all day on, like, social media and whatnot. Like, I just want to see a cozy, comforting show. That's it.
Right. No, I understand that. And you're already under a time crunch. You're already stressed. You guys are all home self-taught chefs. It's like, you're already creating the drama within your own mind, you know, and then you have to say everything out loud. As far as the contract and all that stuff goes, that's pretty, I was shocked at first, but I'm genuinely not surprised because it honestly reminds me of all that Disney stuff that used to come out and how they were kind of owned.
Oh yeah.
After several, and then like American Idol or something, it was like always better to be the second, like the runner up. Kind of deal. Are you happy that you went through this experience? Is a learning curve for you, or is it something that you kind of wish, you know, maybe you didn't sign, even though you got, you know, around everything?
I think it definitely jump started certain things because it gave me confidence to reach out to people. It was definitely helpful in that way. It definitely wasn't gonna help me gain legitimacy anywhere, but it gave me the confidence to reach out to, you know, startups and say, hey, can I do some recipe development or social media or whatever it may be for you? I think that a lot of us went in thinking that they would have done a little bit more when it came to like marketing and press for us with the hopes of them doing more, but they didn't. And it was on us. And then some of us were like, all right, fine. It's on me. I'll do it. And some of us were like, I don't have the time or energy for this, and went back to their day jobs. So for me, I know I'm like very lucky. There's only a handful of folks that didn't win and still stayed in the food industry. Like Monty, I just met Monty a few weeks ago.
I know Claudia won your season.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. I saw her a few weeks ago too. But people that didn't win that are still in the food industry and have like kind of been able to make it, not a lot. Not a lot.
Yeah. Well, it's a competitive industry in general, but I have talked to quite a few who've probably hinted at, hey, use social media now, because that's really where you're going to get your start.
Yep.
I spoke to Tanya Holland on this podcast too.
Oh, I love
Tanya.
And
isn't she amazing? I absolutely love her.
Yeah.
But she's, you know, not, she'll speak out basically, you know, so she was, I can't remember if we were talking about Top Chef or Master.
It has to be Top. She's on Top Chef. Yeah.
Yeah, it was Top Chef. Okay. And she was kind of calling out how it was a boys' club. She felt like there were some inadequacies and you know, inequalities in certain things. And, you know, a lot of viewers or whoever didn't necessarily love that. And I think it's absolutely necessary. I mean, I think maybe, I don't know if there's progress in MasterChef. It's honestly been kind of the same thing.
Yeah. Hasn't been, it looks like, because like I recently was asked to go back for their All-Stars season, and the contract was worse. The contract was like, oh, consent to non-consensual physical touch. We own your NFTs and your image in perpetuity. Like all this crazy stuff. And I was like, yeah, absolutely not.
No.
Yeah.
In this day and age, the consent thing, I'm like, are you kidding me?
Like, I remember seeing that, and I'm like, that's a red flag.
Beyond red flag.
And you're getting paid like $40 a day, and you're filming 3 months. Like, in reality, is the ROI?
Are you paid for that? I don't know if I knew that.
Yeah, you get a $40 stipend for food every day. So, that's it.
Okay, so I guess you're eating one meal a day.
Yeah. Maybe the numbers have gone up since then, but it was $42 a day when I was on there. And I don't think it's changed much because you are free labor. You are cheap free labor for them to make millions.
Okay, at that point, though, I would say don't even give me the $40. Yeah, like, that's just insult.
That's why you see so many reality TV contestants now trying to form unions. Especially, I think it started with someone from Love is Blind, I want to say, that's like spearheading it. But there are reasons why. You're working anywhere between 12 to 16 hours a day, 6 days a week. The only time you get off is when the union, like the cameramen, have to have off. You are not fed properly. Like, I wasn't getting fed properly at all, to the point where the Wranglers took pity on me and were feeding me food from the union truck.
What? Okay, but you're cooking.
Yeah, you're not allowed to eat it.
That doesn't make sense in my brain. Yeah. But
like they would order like.
I guess if you're not, I don't know, but you have all these ingredients around you, so you can't just like make a quick meal. No. Like, I don't understand that. I mean, it's.
I wish. I yeah, no. They like they would order pepperoni pizza and then tell me to take the pepperoni off, which I can't. I will get sick. They'd order breakfast burritos with bacon in it. So like they wouldn't have food for me. So I was living off of like the chips and like bars that they had from the snack table. And they would our wranglers would sometimes take pity on me and I'd be like, can we stop at Porto's or can we stop at Taco Bell or something so I can have a meal? Like I was losing weight.
Oh yeah, I can imagine. If you're just eating bars and you're running around. You're standing for 12 to 16 hours. But 2015 is not far away enough for them not to recognize a vegetarian.
Yeah, yeah. It was
like, it's not.
I cried. I lost it.
Well, for them to have you say it over and over, hey, I'm a vegetarian, for drama, not feed you, is absolutely wild. Right?
Like, I remember we filmed in Vegas and we were having breakfast. It was like 3 a.m. We were having breakfast. And we're walking and I see the breakfast and there's literally nothing I could eat.
Oh my gosh.
Nothing.
I would have passed out.
And I was so mad. I started crying at that point. And I was just like done with it. And then that night, some of my wranglers snuck me out of the hotel room to get me a meal. And it was like my first meal I had in like a long time. Cause I was there all 3 months.
Yeah. 3 months is a crazy long time for that.
So it was just like not for me. Like even down to like makeup and hair, like they didn't have my shade.
They still often don't in many.
So yeah. I had no, like everyone got a full face of makeup. I did not. I only got lipstick and maybe a little bit of color correction. And I had to do that myself.
They didn't like go out and have any darker shades.
No.
Okay. I have a lot to say and also nothing to say at the same time.
Right? Like there's a lot that went down on that show.
You want to say you're 14 hours or?
A lot went down on that show that I was just like, I see the reality of this. And now I'm like jaded from it.
I'm not even confident. It's gotten better. Too. Yeah. That's very disappointing.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sorry you've experienced that because it's such an exciting thing. And I understand getting frustrated to a point where you just absolutely break down in tears. Like you can't even be angry anymore. You're just
tired.
Just cry. And you're tired. Mm-hmm. It's exhausting. And especially then seeing these comments online and no one regulating it is, I mean, it's basically running wild. I had an internship with a food blog back in college and she would have me go through the comments and delete the incredibly negative, crazy ones, which they would be reported anyways. But when they're coming in such quantities, I can only imagine how that affects you mentally. Yeah. Too, because even if someone says like your hair looks stupid on it on something, I'm like, no, it doesn't. I get so mad.
I mean,
I know I need to take a step back because I don't even know these people. But
I'm like, that's exactly. I was like, I don't even want to do this. Like in the sense of, I don't want to respond and have a back and forth with this person, because like on the show, they also, if you're a person of color, they will make hints that they want you to make food from your culture consistently. And then what you'll see is people say, all she does is make Indian food or all she does is make Mexican food. They can't be master chef. But the dude who's making Italian food every week is totally fine for him.
It is, because he's a man in society.
Yeah.
You're also a woman. So there's like layer, layer, layer. And it's just like, that is, that's absolutely insane. Well, maybe, and you have done this, you've made a platform where now you can do Indian influenced food and you can do whatever you want and your deal with them is done. So now you wrote a cookbook. Was your cookbook under the deal with them or this was after?
I waited until my contract was up with them, which is 3 years. And then I did my first book with Page Street Publishing. And that book just blew up beyond what I expected.
Oh, that's incredible, though.
I was a full surprise because, like, I think any author can say, like, goes through this phase of, like, no one's going to buy my book. Everyone's going to hate it. Like, I'm just writing this for no one. Like, all the self-doubt that comes. And then Priya Krishna.
Oh, I love her. She was on here on my podcast as well.
She's so sweet. Like, she wrote an article about the book in the New York Times.
Oh.
And that set it off. That's all it took. Because as soon as the New York Times took a hold of it, every other, you know, media company is like, we want to hear more. Tell us more. What can we feature? And it just became much bigger. It became, and then I had like a BuzzFeed video from it go viral. And
oh, that's big. BuzzFeed.
Yeah, back then, yeah.
At the time, huge. I'm like, now I don't know if they're not as big anymore. But no, then I was like scrolling through those videos like
crazy. Yeah.
I remember.
Especially BuzzFeed Tasty. This is like the era of hands and pans.
Oh, yeah, yeah. My friend, her girlfriend was on this podcast as well. My gosh, there's so many connections. But she was basically like the person that was the face of BuzzFeed Tasty when it first started.
Yeah.
It was Alex. Do you know Alex Traeger?
Yeah, yeah, I know.
Oh, Alex. Okay.
Yeah, yeah, I met her there.
When
yeah.
I met her, I was like, you're behind all of the videos that I used to watch. Wow, yeah, that's big, though.
Like, I remember seeing, meeting Rie at the BuzzFeed headquarters. And I'm like, oh my God, it's Rie.
You're like, you know, the hands in the video. This is crazy. Because they were always the most like outlandish things ever. But I always saved them. I don't know if I was making them or whatever I was doing. But
I think my video got like over 5 million views, which back then is massive.
Well, still now.
I feel like now like 5 million is like viral, but like it can be more viral.
Yeah, like, you're right, it could be like 10-20. Yeah
So like that's all, it just blew up on its own. And then once that kind of happened and the pandemic hit and I was just constantly making content because I was bored at home, it just grew from there. It was just really wild and part luck, part hard work, part just like being in the right place at the right time.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm sure. And the process, I know, takes so long. And, you know, you put your heart and soul in everything. What was your headspace like at that time that you released your first book? Because I'm sure maybe mentally for MasterChef, it probably wasn't the best. So did you feel like you evolved up until like 2019 when you released it?
Yeah, I had a very different career at that point.
Okay.
So like I was doing social media management for restaurants and food startups. I was doing food photography and food styling as well. So my life was like me doing client work and running to a different client every day because I was just freelancing. And I thought like, this is what I'm going to do forever. And then literally just spending a few hours a week on my blog. I was maybe putting one new recipe up a blog a week. One new recipe up on the blog a week. The book was just a side project. I didn't see it as something I could jump off of.
That's a hell of a side project.
like it was just like, this is just something I want to put out in the world. And like, you know, I had no expectations. The fact that like it resonated. The other thing is Indian American cuisine at that time was just being defined, right? Priya Krishna's book came out in 2019 too, Indian-ish. Yeah. And it was the first time where a lot of Indian Americans were seeing the cuisine that we grew up with in a book being defined, showing the evolution of our cuisine as it is now. I ended up getting balled into one of the thought leaders of defining what Indian American food looks like. That was not an expectation at all. Like, I didn't think other people had the same experiences as me. I thought it was very much like, I'm from New Jersey. Maybe some other Indian people from New Jersey might like feel a connection and resonate. But I didn't expect it to resonate amongst the massive Indian American population across America. And to see that, it was like very surprising to me. you just don't expect that like something you write is going to have that much of an impact on anything or anyone, to be honest.
Well, it's also a tangible thing, you know, mm-hmm. when you see people and then at that point they're posting with it, they're doing. And I mean, like you said, it's shocking that there was a gap in the industry in 2019, but you know, there was, and then there was Indianish and then there was your book. And now it's like, there's so many others.
American.
You know, and... you're just kind of getting started and mm-hmm. it's impressive that you're able to put something out there too, because I know a lot of publishers as well often want the Italian cooking books, or they want like the classic American food books or the burgers or whatever. Yeah. So now there's like so much more expansion that people are excited. And, mm-hmm. you know, you were kind of in the beginning of that for your Indian food.
Yeah. It's wild to see. 'Cause like recently my sister went to like a cafe in Jersey and she brought home a gulab jamun cake. And I'm like, that's my recipe. I know, because I tasted it and I was like, that's my cake.
That's so funny. Wait, she bought it or she cooked it?
She bought it at the cafe. What? And oh my they gosh. Were serving an iteration of my cake.
You should email them and be like, hey, what are you using? What are you using over there?
Because I'm like, I've made that cake millions of times. I know what my cake texture and flavor is like. And I'm like, that's my recipe. I know it.
That's the biggest compliment, I think.
And I'm like, dang. Yeah, it is. It's a huge compliment in the sense of like, I made a difference and an impact on the evolution of Indian American food and how people eat and create, you know?
Mm-hmm. Well, that's now crazy. You have Desi Bakes.
Yeah.
Which you just wrapped up that book tour, right?
Yeah. Well, part one of that book tour.
Wait, are you coming to LA?
I'm trying to find a partner in LA to do something with. So if you know anyone, please let me know. But the plan is to do like Chicago, LA, Texas, do Portland, Seattle next year. And then I'm going back to New York as well for an event at the James Beard Platform space. But I'm like very excited about it. But yeah, I wrapped up part one of the book tour. And the book is basically desserts that have, it's more about decorating than anything else. That's the way I can explain it. So
that is the thing I'm worst at. So I would need this book.
Yeah. Like I want people to have fun and see the world around them and take inspiration from the world around them and apply that to their bake. So in this book, I take textiles, art, handicrafts, visual parts of being in India, and I use that as inspiration to decorate my cakes, cookies a certain way. They're all abstract, so there's no like right or wrong way to do any of it. But it's just like I want people to like enjoy the decorating aspect of it. I want people to have fun with the colors and the sprinkles and gold and glitter and just get into it. I think people forget what it's like to like be creative as adults, especially. I mean, I'm hoping that, you know, it inspires people to be more creative and look at the world around them and find the art in the world, art and beauty in the world around them.
I know. I think with baking too, they feel like there's a lot of rules. Mm-hmm. It's like, which there are, because, you know, with your background, I'm sure you know it's scientific, but I think that it's really fun that you're highlighting decorating in that way. And you can kind of just explore and be yourself. 'Cause I always get very frustrated when I can't do fondant on a cake or something, because I cannot.
I can't even do fondant on a cake, to be honest. Okay. I don't want to do fondant on a cake. Oof.
No, it's kind of gross, but like I tried once and it was an absolute failure. So there is a little cookbook shop, actually, that I should give you the name of, because I went, Zoe Francois had her cookbook signing there.
Now Serving?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. You already knew.
Yeah.
I really liked it though. It was like this, mm-hmm. it was in Chinatown or something, but it was very cute.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. It's in Chinatown.
Was your experience this time around, you know, emotionally, did you feel more confident? Were you less stressed with the second book, or maybe the same as the first time? What were your feelings?
I was, I think, a little bit more stressed, only because mm-hmm. I wanted to make sure that this book wasn't just like Milk and Cardamom part two. Like I wanted to. And the other thing is, I know decorating is very intimidating to folks. And I was like, how do I convince people that this is not intimidating or scary? Like, I don't want people to open it and then immediately be like, oh, that looks really hard, and then put it back down, you know?
Guilty. Three counts guilty.
Yeah. So like, there's a stress there of like, how do I make sure that people understand that I promise you, this is not as difficult as it looks. And then the other is, oh, well, I put a brownie recipe in my first book. Can I put a brownie recipe in this book? Like, how much,
I understand that.
Like, crossover can I have? Are people going to be like, why do you have three recipes and like that are based from Besan Ki Barfi, which is like an Indian sweet from chickpea flour? Like, I have a Besan Ki Barfi Rice Krispie Treats. I have Besan Ki Barfi cream pie. And then I have like one other version. I also have like multiple versions of Gajar Ka Halwa, which is like a carrot based sweet. I did like a tart and I did a blondie version of it. So I'm like, oh, like, is that bad? Is it okay? And I realized, you know what? The recipe's good though. So I'm just going to
I was going to say the only reason you need is it tastes good. If anyone asks, and if they don't like it, that's their problem.
Exactly. I'm like, but the recipe works. So I'm going to go with it. Also, this time I had a agent and I had an editor that was like a little bit more hands-on. And it made such a big difference. Like, it made me feel a bit more confident in what I was doing.
Which sweets, because the holidays are coming up, what sweets are you cooking up for the holiday season?
So I have my favorite recipe out of my newest book is a tender coconut cream pie. It is so good. I think it will convert any coconut hater because it's tender coconut. So
I'm a little of a coconut hater. I'm sorry.
It's okay. But tender coconut's way different. Like, if you like coconut water, this will work because it's not the same as dried, like mature coconut. It doesn't have the same flavor. Like, it's much more refreshing and lighter. I think it's just like absolutely delicious. So some of that, and then cookies, lots and lots of cookies. So I'm all about the cookie life right now.
Oh, same. I actually was just, I've been talking to my mom for 3 days on what ingredients I need when I go home to visit to make cookies.
A lot of butter.
A lot of butter. A treadmill, maybe. No, I'm kidding. No treadmills over Christmas. Yeah, chocolate. I'm a chocolate gal, so it's always going to be that. What do you think is the most underrated Indian influenced dessert, either that you've created or is a staple in the culture? I always love to ask this when I'm not super in the know of what
The desserts are. I would say Besan Ki Barfi. So Besan Ki Barfi is chickpea flour that's toasted in ghee until it gets like a very nutty flavor, almost like peanut butter. And then traditionally you would make like a sugar syrup and mix it together and set it like a fudge. In my first book, I have a traditional recipe where I use powdered sugar and I mix the toasted chickpea flour and ghee with powdered sugar and then let it set into a fudge. The flavor is just unreal. It's like, if you're allergic to like peanuts, you could totally use this, and it gives you that like peanutty flavor that I love. And it's just a very cozy, warm dessert.
I love those nostalgic desserts too that are just like make you feel warm and fuzzy.
Yeah.
And that's, and I'll just like eat 30 cookies because I feel warm and fuzzy.
You know what? I'm here for it. I feel like sometimes it's called self-care, right?
That is my form of self-care for sure. Eating hot Hershey's, whatever. Mm-hmm. I normally make hot cocoa cookies actually. Ooh. I wrote about it for All Recipes and it should go up soon, but I found this recipe on like the back of the Hershey Kisses bag and I make them every time now, and they go within 24 hours, they're gone. And like my family is like, want to make another batch? I'm like, yeah.
Love.
Yes. For you, aside from your cookbook, you have your, you know, part two probably coming up with your book tour. Is there anything else going on? I know you have a partnership that's in the works.
Yeah. So I am partnering with Challenge Butter and Cookies for Kids Cancer this holiday season. Challenge Butter and Cookies for Kids Cancer have partnered for an initiative called A Challenge for a Cure. So the way that works is they're hoping that people will hold bake sales and make donations for kids' cancer research. And
that's incredible,
right? Especially in, during the holiday, it's the season of giving and, you know, doing something good for the people around you. This is a really like a cause that's very near and dear to my heart. I worked in I did research in oncological drugs when I was a biochemist for a few years, and I had family members that had pediatric cancer. So it's a very like close to my heart. So, and mixed with baking, I feel like this is like the perfect mesh of something that I can really just want to support during the holidays.
That's so sweet. Yeah. And nothing is better than a good old bake sale.
Yes, I agree.
You can't get better than that. I remember my first one, I did it for a club in college, mm-hmm. and we had nothing. Like, we had no mixing bowls. We had nothing. I had to get my mom to get me some plastic mixing bowls. Like, it was a little bit of a disaster, but also a really great time.
Right. So. It's like you're bonding and you're making a bunch of stuff. Yeah. I headed bake sales at, this is so dorky.
So no, I love it.
I went to a college called University of the Sciences in Philly. It no longer exists. It was bought out by St. Joe's. But... But
that's okay.
But I did this bake sale. I would do a periodic table of brownies bake sale. I started it at my college, and they to this day they still do it.
No way.
Yeah, and
you're the one behind the periodic table of brownies.
So like all the gases would be like, you know, a caramel brownie, and all these elements would be a certain type of brownie. So I broke it down based.
That's so funny.
So dorky.
No, I love it. I'm actually a nerd at heart. Spoiler alert, everyone. I actually love learning and I love school. Okay.
But
so I'm impressed.
I'm here for it. I feel like those bake sales, like that was definitely a big start of like my love for baking.
Wow, that's so fun. Okay, but it's fun to like create your own things. That's like, that's the creative part of your brain itching.
Yeah. 100%.
All right. So I have a short game for you if you're up for it. I basically I do this with every guest, but I'll name like a popular, this time it'll be Christmas or holiday pastries or beverages. Okay. And then you'll say if it's a smash or pass.
Got it.
Okay. First one. I feel like I'm going to say this wrong because I'm just myself and I should have looked up the pronunciation. Madeleines. Okay.
If they're fresh, smash. If they're not fresh, pass.
Okay. I can get down with that. The second one, a berry chantilly cake.
Oh, smash.
The Whole Foods
Absolutely. Yeah, I'm all about that whipped cream plus fruit cake. I'm about that life.
I love a good fruit cake as well. All right. Third one, eggnog.
Pass.
Yeah, it's disgusting. If you're drinking eggnog, I have a lot of questions. Fourth one, peppermint bark.
Smash.
Agreed. Fifth one, peanut butter blossoms.
Oh, smash all the way. Oh my God. I love peanut butter blossoms. They're so good.
Are so good. I actually used to hate peanut butter, which I used to be a very picky human being. So I really didn't like peanut butter. My sister would eat it all the time to the point where like she would just like eat. I'm exposing her right now. She would eat spoonfuls. I don't know. Spoonful. Thank you. I'm like not okay today. In my defense, I had to get up really early for an event. So I was
like, I get it. It's a Monday.
I was like, I knew that didn't sound right. Okay, anyways, spoonfuls of peanut butter, and it would make me nauseous because she would like eat it in the car, or she would just like eat it, and then I couldn't do it anymore. So years later, I've evolved as a human, and now I enjoy peanut butter. That is my long-winded, not very interesting story. See, I love this podcast because I can just say my dumbest stories and people have to listen.
It's okay. What we've learned is exposure therapy doesn't work for you. It does the opposite.
No,
it makes
contract.
An aversion.
Yeah. There's no contract here. You're in the clear. All right. My final question for you that I also ask every single guest is, if there was one cooking utensil or appliance you think everyone should splurge on, what would it be and why?
Okay. This is so stupid and specific.
Okay. No, I want
the the Tovolo FlexCore mini spatula / spoonula.
That is the best answer I've ever gotten. I want you to.
I am really picky about my spatulas, like very. There are things that a spatula must have, characteristics they must have.
Okay.
One, it should be one singular unit of silicone, because the silicone always falls off the wooden handle. That's where mold grows. Like, things can go wrong. So it has to be one single unit. When it says it's heat proof, it has to be heat proof. I've had so many melt on me when they said they were heat proof and they weren't.
I've had that too. That just happened to me and it really irked
right?
me. Right? Yeah.
The other is, when you're scraping down your bowl, it should be flexible enough to scrape, but stiff enough to actually scrape your bowl clean. Nothing's worse than when you have a floppy, like loose silicone that when you're pressing down, it's not actually pressing down enough. So then you just have like this thin layer of batter stuck to your bowl.
I know exactly what you're talking about.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, I really do.
And it has to be like curved enough and fit well enough that it actually does like scrape your bowl down, not just like the 2 inches that are touching, you know? So the shape has to be right. And then the other thing that I really need it to have is, I have a family of 3. So my meals are very small compared to most people. I hate using a big spatula in a small pot. Like, it just feels weird. Like, it feels like, you know, like it's.
No, it's. I understand. Yeah.
Yeah. So the small mini spatula works great. And this Tovolo FlexCore spoonula spatula works great. The other thing I need
is
that when you scrape the bowl, right? You know how you like sometimes will wipe the excess off the edge of the lip of your bowl?
Yes.
The spoon, the shape of your spatula has to be that, so that when you scrape the edge, all of the stuff comes off of it, not like just the center and then the edges still has batter stuck to it, or this, you know, it's so curved and so stiff that the little bit in the curve is still there. So
okay.
Yeah. It's very, I know.
Do you work with that company? Because you should.
I don't. But I know it's so OCD and like very specific.
No, but everything you said makes so much sense in my brain. And now I'm thinking about all the times that it frustrated me with my spatula. And I'm like, you're so correct.
Yeah. Yeah. And it gets in between like the paddle attachment, like, you know, the little gaps in the paddle attachment for your mixer. Uh-huh. It's small enough that you could scrape the batter off of that and get everything out as well.
That is worst.
Right?
It's the worst. Yeah.
Because like the big spatula doesn't get in there. So yeah, that's my favorite tool.
Okay. You win. Never have I ever had someone be that specific, but you win. Podcast is over.
I'm like, I know this is psychotic, but
oh, but I am that type. I am a little psychotic. Like, so I appreciate this. The passion and the enthusiasm. Okay. Well, that was my last question for you. So thank you so, so much. This was an absolute blast. It was riveting. I hope exposure therapy worked for you. I hope it works for others listening.
Yes.
It was so amazing to meet you, though, that you're really an inspiration, not just to your culture, but everyone else who's followed your journey and everything. And I'm excited to see where everything went up. And, you know, your second cookbook, I'm sure it's already a slam dunk. So
thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it. It was fun chatting with you.
Of course. Okay. So you can keep up with Hethel on Instagram at Milk and Cardamom, or you can snag her cookbook on Amazon. I'll add it to my storefront under podcast guests, as I usually do, named Desi Bakes, 85 recipes bringing the best of Indian flavors to Western style desserts, which is out now.
Hey, fellow foodies, thanks so much for listening. And don't forget to leave me a review. While you're at it, make sure to follow me at Living for Food Pod on Instagram or TikTok, or email me at livingforfoodpod@gmail.com. Let me know what you're cooking up this week, which guests you would like to see on the podcast, or tell me your opinions on the latest viral food trend. And in case you're just joining me, there is an entirety of season 1 ready and waiting for you. Until next time.